Good evening. Welcome to the One Liner Podcast. I'm Bane. With me is Batman. How are you, Batman?
Throw me the money.
Not really, of course, the simple power of suggestion. I am Scott Morris. This is the One Liner Podcast. Joining me today is Drew Tavendale. We are not joined by our usual compatriot, Craig Eastman, who is off in Bavaria. I believe he checked in earlier. I think he's riding a wild boar jousting with some kind of bear. I'm not sure. But anyway, he's away.
Trying desperately not to mention the war, I believe. He did it once, but he got away with it.
We have a veritable shedload to get through, so we'll try and keep it tight. And I've only got 4 bottles of Corona to see me through, so we'll try and get through it in a jiffy. So we shall start off with A Few Best Men. Drew, what's that all about?
Well, having met the girl of his dreams on holiday in the Far East, David arrives back in London to announce to his dim-witted friends that he's going to marry her. And so they all traipse off to Australia for the wedding, where his bride-to-be's family have already taken care of all the arrangements, and all David and his mates need to do is cock it up, which they do, and humour fails to ensue. A fairly obvious comparison for this movie, which most other reviewers as well as myself have made, with its excesses, its drunkenness, inadvertently pissed off criminals, unremembered happenings, drugs, all centred around a wedding, is The Hangover. But A Few Best Men just doesn't bear the scrutiny. The Hangover did nothing original, except perhaps make Bradley Cooper watchable. There was nothing in it that anyone hadn't seen before, often many times. What it did do, though, was take things we'd all seen before, hone it to a fine edge, and execute it perfectly. And it's that that made The Hangover such a success. But this film doesn't do that. In fact, mostly it does the opposite of that. The writing is lazy, the acting poor, the execution sloppy, and the whole thing just tawdry. The characters are, to an individual, featureless and charisma-free, and there's even a man who loves his sheep more than his family. And it would feel like it was Brits tiresomely trotting out the stereotypes of Australians as sheep shaggers if, unbelievably, this film wasn't funded and directed by Australians. The whole thing is just so very, very weak. We seem to be relying on knob jokes, somebody saying tits, tits are funny.
Tits are funny.
And fecal humour, without actually having anything funny or well delivered. So by the end, which frankly couldn't arrive quickly enough, there was one film I was irresistibly reminded of. It had been coming for a while, and it's almost exactly like it. One film that it's so similar to, and it's not The Hangover, but it's Death at a Funeral. Exactly. Need I say more? Well, actually, yes, one more thing, turns out, and I only bothered to look him up on IMDb 30 minutes ago, that the writer of this is in fact the writer of Death at a Funeral. I really didn't predict that, I just thought this is awfully like it, but it's nigh on the same film. So apparently he only has one film in him, and it's not a good one.
I haven't seen this, don't particularly feel like doing so, especially when the IMDb tells me that people who like this also liked Friends with Benefits, the Justin Timberlake Mila Kunis shitfest. Proves that people like this have no taste. So if you do disagree with Drew, you have no taste.
Never a truer word spoken. So, from a film with a large sequence based on blow to a film with large sequences based on blowing things up, then, Scott. Expendables 2. Was that bad enough?
Now, I don't think anyone would have been screaming out for a sequel to Expendables. It was a film which had a lot of promise and delivered almost nothing. It just didn't really kick off in a way that I think anyone particularly wanted it to. It should have been an over-the-top action spectacular, and it wasn't. So, the news of a second one with a lower rating, this has gone for the 15 rating, didn't seem that it was going to be heading in the right overkill direction that I really wanted it to. Somehow thrown a bit of a curveball. It's actually substantially better than the first one, and it's basically everything that I thought was wrong in the first one has more or less been fixed in this.
It's a curveball.
There's not a hell of a lot of plot to really tell you about. The gang, led by Sylvester Stallone's group of mercenaries, are reunited for one more job, which should be easy, but it goes a bit Pete Tong when the gizmo that they're called upon to retrieve from a crash site, which gives the map to some tonnage of uranium, falls into the hands of Jean-Claude Van Damme's evil army of Eastern European ne'er-do-wells, and in the process killing the youngest of the Expendables' new crew. And the whole plot after that is basically to get revenge and to stop Jean-Claude Van Damme's little army by any means possible, those means generally being high-caliber weaponry. It does a lot of things right. It's by no means the best action film that there's ever been. It has still some of the flaws of the first film, in as much as you've seen the cast, it has everybody in it, so no one's going to get particularly deep characterization here. But what it has done is use those cast in a way that basically trades on all of their previous works, which is really what the first one should have done. I mean, no one wanted to establish a franchise of serious action films. What people wanted from this was a love letter to 80s, 90s action films, all over the top, lots of silly violence and over the top shenanigans. The first Expendables film really went down the route of being a commoner garden action film that just happened to have a ridiculous cast, apart from a few over the top violent deaths for, you know, spattered around for no particularly good reason. What they've done in this one is they've upped all the dials on the silliness of the action, and to be honest, it seems to be just about as violent, although somewhat less gratuitous, and they've just called it a 15 rather than an 18. I have no idea how this got through it as a 15.
The power of persuasion.
There are so many people getting shot in this, and it's not like it's particularly shy about showing you the consequences of it, which is something that'll remind me to get into with Total Recall, but there's no shortage of action and crimson being flying. A lot of characters who just showed up for 2 seconds have now got bigger roles. Guys like Arnold Schwarzenegger's actually back shooting a gun. It gives all these characters their moment in the sun in a far more organic way than it did in the first one, where it seemed to just sort of cut to, you know, Steve Austin fighting some other guy for no particularly good reason. It's done a better job of hiding the weaknesses of some of the cast, some of the guys like Randy Couture, who are obviously not actors, and it does show, but they look convincing in action roles when they're used that way. Does far better jobs of guys like Dolph Lundgren. Within the first 5 minutes, it won me over by having Jet Li going mental on people with 2 frying pans. Can't get enough of that. Sylvester Stallone and Jason Statham still have really good charisma, do quite a good double act, and Statham himself still happily throws knives everywhere. There's a lot of very well executed action scenes. It doesn't slow down too much over the course of the piece. The cameos from, yeah, they're still effectively cameos from guys like Willis and Chuck Norris, are well handled, and they're slightly ironic. I did get the impression that the first Expendables film wanted to be taken seriously as a work of art to some extent, whereas Expendables 2 has just gone, okay, you wanted something that borders on parody of old action films, and this is it. It's a slightly toned down Tropic Thunder, and I think it's all the stronger for it. Chuck Norris even gets to tell facts about himself.
That's an ACN joke. I like the sound of that.
It has a kind of light-hearted feel to most of it, which I think makes the film pull together a lot better than its first one did. It feels like it has a better understanding of the target audience. It's not the best action film that you will see this year, but it is one of the more fun action films that you'll see this year. You know, it borders more in the direction of something like Crank 2 or something, where it is sort of silly enough. There's, by the end of it, there's people getting gunned down left, right and centre, and it's by no means a serious work of art, but it's a hell of a lot of fun to watch. And I have to say, after, I've forgotten what the last film Jean-Claude Van Damme was in that we'd reviewed talked about, but it was pretty bad, if memory serves, whereas he's gone back on form in this one. I can't recall seeing him being a villain in recent times, and he does it very well, actually. That was something of a revelation. That's, you know, quite a good role for him to be in, and it works pretty well.
Certainly, when you were describing the film, you had me at Jean-Claude Van Damme's Evil Army.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you did lose me when you added From Eastern Europe, because already I had a picture in my head of skeletal warriors, possibly even a Charles Horty skeleton from Army of Darkness.
Yeah,
let's get the hell out of here!
It's desperately missing a Bruce Campbell. That's one for the third one. I think it has a very narrow target audience. I think if you were of the younger generation and came and sat in front of Expendables 2, you'll probably be quite confused by a lot of things that are going on in there. There's a lot of references to films that are probably older than a lot of the people that might be going to see the film in a lot of circumstances, over and above the usual sort of I'll be back, I'm back Schwarzenegger things. There's other references to, at this point, fairly decrepit action films, and it's a love letter to the kind of films that I suppose we grew up with, and for us guys with our background, I think it's worth a look. It's certainly much better than original, and I enjoyed it quite a lot, far more than I thought I would. I had to kind of drag myself to see the film at the end of the day, but I'm quite glad that I did. It was surprisingly well executed. Only real complaint is it suffers a little bit from Xbox first-person perspective shooter colour palettes, in as much as the entire film is essentially either grey or brown. It could do with a little bit of colour, well, apart from red, obviously.
I imagine there's plenty of red.
The locations could do with being a little bit more interesting, but other than that, well handled, quite funny, decent action scenes, well worth a look. Not going to be mentioned in the films of the year roundup, but it certainly is a welcome surprise, and it's better than a lot of films I've seen this year. So yeah, if you have any love for the action genre, give it a bash. from a love letter to 90s action films through a remake of one of our favourite 90s action films. I don't think anyone was looking forward to Total Recall. I don't think we were, but
no.
Drew watched it, so report back, Drew. What news of Recall?
What news of Recall, indeed. Unfortunately, I can recall it quite well. I don't think I'm imagining this, Scott, because I'm fairly sure we discussed this in the past that you'd heard a similar thing, that the filmmakers here were suggesting that this was going to be a bit closer to the original source material.
Yeah, I had heard that.
And that it was going to be a bit different from Total Recall.
Perhaps they had a misunderstanding of what the source material was.
Yes, and what the word different means. Because they seem to think it means same, but worse. Yes, I'm sure I remember hearing that, and of course if that were genuinely the case, they would have called it We Can Remember It For You Wholesale instead of taking the movie's name. But it's, in terms of what happens in it, if you've seen the Paul Verhoeven Total Recall, you've seen this film, just that Mars is now Australia. Well, that's it, that's the difference, Mars is now Australia. And certainly in terms of plot, the only other differences are that it's worse in every conceivable way. Genuinely, staggeringly worse in every conceivable way. It's like they've gone out with that as their mission statement. Worst dialogue, check. Worst acting, check. Less sense, check. And then also, here's the very strange thing, it manages to completely bypass the whole Recall element of it, which is such a large chunk of the original. Of course, we have Doug Quaid. He's bothered by memories and the dullness of his life. He goes to Recall to try and get new memories, and that process breaks the seal on his old memories and starts the whole thing, and also becomes a significant plot point later. In this one, Colin Farrell, who plays Doug Quaid, is having these weird dreams and is disappointed with the dullness of his life and goes to Recall to get some new memories, but then doesn't, because the guy at Recall turns to him and says, "You've got some fake memories," in which he says, "Have I? Oh, right then." And then some soldiers turn up. It's mind-bogglingly stupid. Even the bits that are meant to be the basis of the story aren't in it. Really?
I could probably defend on that point. There's at least some slight ambiguity in as much as you're never supposed to really know. The whole point of it is that, you know, they're putting these chemicals into him, which is supposed to have the memories inside him, and it's saying that he's somehow already got them. We've used a brain scanner. He's already got stuff in there. Pull the tube out before it gets in. And I think the point is you're never supposed to really know whether that chemical gets there or doesn't, whether he's been implanted with these false memories and having a fit, or whether he actually is one.
I might accept some of that argument, but it seems so poorly done, whereas in the original he is in the machine, so you're generally for the rest of the film not sure whether he's dreaming it or not.
Yeah.
Whereas this leaves you wondering whether actually he got that far or not, so it weakens that plot point.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the From the Red Carpet M&M sort of spiel that's been going around in front of films for the last couple of weeks?
Yes.
It's Total Recall. And obviously they're interviewing the actors and actresses on the red carpet, and they ask Colin Farrell what they think he's going to see over the old one. And you can tell they've cut away about a couple of minutes of him going, why should you watch this? Because when he comes back, he's got that kind of apologetic tone in his voice, saying, well, the aesthetics of it are pretty good. And I will grant him that. For the most part, it does look quite nice. I mean, it's stolen from Blade Runner, obviously, but for about the first, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, the computer graphics are done in the way the background and the world design is quite nicely done. I thought that was quite well handled. For almost everything up until you get to Recall, it was probably doing a better job than the old one was, because, well, you're not lumbered with Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to emote. Colin Farrell, for all his faults, is a better actor than Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he kind of relays that kind of bit of sort of tedium with his life better. The problem is that's such an inconsequential bit of the film that the hour and a half after it kind of outweighs it, and pretty much everything as soon as they start introducing action elements, I wasn't offended by it, but was very bored by a lot of it.
I will grant you Colin Farrell being a better actor than Arnold Schwarzenegger, although only barely in this. I'm certainly lumbered by much stupider dialogue, which is quite astonishingly clunky in this film. I'll take your Colin Farrell, and I will play my Kate Beckinsale card.
That's not fair.
Who's considerably worse than Arnold Schwarzenegger, although admittedly prettier. But
I had real problems telling Kate Beckinsale and Jessica Biel apart in this film.
Yeah, I had that problem too. And I've seen them in plenty of other things. I know exactly what they look like. But in this, there were a few points I was generally like, one's that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why they did it. Because the first film had such a point of him, the woman and the kind of rebel, being so different from the wife. This one, it seems to be effectively the same person. It puzzles me. What puzzles me is all the points where they've differed, they've made it demonstrably, scientifically, provably worse.
Exactly, yeah.
And they keep throwing in the references to the original that you'd only get if you'd seen the original, and make no sense whatsoever in the context of the film.
Like, I know.
Like, why is that, like, the hooker with three tits? There is at least some semblance of an idea behind that in the Mars version.
Because they're mutants. Going around.
This one,
exactly.
Oh, it's like, I've had plastic surgery to get three tits. Look
and
at
the
me.
Motivations are so much stronger, too. And, oh, apart from Ronnie Cox blowing this other guy off the screen acting-wise, but the original Total Recall, you've got, there's this precious resource on Mars, he controls it. People want it. And that it's simple, but it's really sound.
Yeah.
And then you've got this thing that he's the main character is genuinely afraid of, is the reactor, which will help everybody. And he's not just afraid of losing control. He's genuinely worried that it will blow up the planet.
Yeah.
Right. And then you've got this one. The guy wants to put some robots in Australia for some reason.
There's another thing that is done with it. I will accept, just as a sort of general idea that you can throw out there in a sci-fi film that's not expected to be thought about too much, the concept of the fall, which is essentially an elevator going through the centre of the Earth.
Yes.
Between Britain and Australia. That's actually quite cool. And as a way to have those zero gravity set piece action bits, I will happily go with that. But they also had to make it into some kind of totem of an ill-defined oppression subplot for these rebels.
Yes.
The fall enslaves us all. It's like, how? It is, at the end of the day, just a fancy train. You might as well say that the Edinburgh to Glasgow line enslaves us all. It doesn't make any sense, and it's never expanded upon in any way. The whole concept of it is just really poorly thought out. I don't know why they've tried to put these in, and it's more annoying. There's a whole bunch of these sort of annoying flaws that it can get into. As soon as it turns into an action film, basically, as soon as you hit the first car chase, I sort of immediately checked out the sort of silly hover car things, which just looked like a CG set piece and just kept going that way for the end of the film.
I certainly found that uninteresting, a CG set piece. Also, every car was the same car.
Yep.
Which made things quite tricky to follow.
There just wasn't too much interesting going on there. Annoyingly generic for so much of it.
It would be bad enough on its own if it were just a film that was bad. But then it's a film which is a remake of one of the action greats.
Total Recall is the original, the Paul Verhoeven thing, is by no means high concept art. But you can tell that Verhoeven himself has thought enough about the genre of an action film, he's decided to make his statement on it by having it being so over-the-top violent and having these other little elements in there that you can kind of latch onto and sort of make it a little bit more complicated. What is annoying in this one is that it has taken anything that Verhoeven thought would push the limits of the genre and removed them completely. I was talking about Expendables, where Expendables somehow managed to be very violent and was still showing the consequences of their actions. You don't have that in Total Recall at all. It's taken the coward's way out to get a 12A certificate by, well, partly by just replacing all humans with robots,
yeah.
Which makes it even more annoying when it gives you like the scene in the lift with the arms coming off when that's a robot. It doesn't have anything like the same effect. And at the same time, it's also managed to pussy out with showing the violence against normal people. This is by no means
bleed.
Exactly. I mean, someone gets shot in the head at point blank range and all he does is fall over. Now, this is something that's annoyed me about the new genre of action films that have to be, you know, sanitised for mass market 12A rating consumptions. I find it incredibly offensive to have people going about shooting people left, right and centre, and you never see any consequences of that happening at all. I think it's irresponsible. It's glamorising violence in a way that really wouldn't be if you actually showed, you know, the actual mess and gore.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's making everything seem far more like a video game in the old school things where there is no consequences to anything happening. I think cinema, it offends me to even call Total Recall cinema, this version, but there should be some method at its best to teach people that there's, if you do these things, there are these consequences, you should see these consequences rather than just having them be glossed over.
People will be dead and messy.
It's a stupid complaint, but it has something that's been happening basically for about a decade and a half now, and it annoys me. I don't think it's responsible filmmaking.
No, I don't think it's responsible anything, really.
Also, there's so many other annoying flaws in the film where, like, pretty sure at the end of this film, Kate Beckinsale could actually teleport, because the amount of times they run away from her in the fastest possible conveyance, then she just appears somewhere else.
See,
it's lazy and annoying.
Her character bothered me in particular, one of many things, and I really tried to go into this film with an open mind as much as I could. I wasn't looking forward to it. I thought, I'll watch it, I'll give it a go. The last time I saw a Len Wiseman film, it really, really surprised me in being in any way competent at all, yeah. Which was Die Hard 4. But from the start, it was just on my wrong side right along. And that character in particular bothered me. In the original, she's basically two characters. She's Sharon Stone and Michael Ironside.
Yes, and a poor replacement for both.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, you see, both of those characters have motivations for wanting Quaid dead. You've got Sharon Stone, who has professed clearly early on how much she hates Mars, and she gets there and she just gets a bit mean. She just wants it over because she hates being there. She hates having travelled billions of miles to get this guy. And more particularly, Michael Ironside, who has had to watch his wife sleep with this guy and who probably also resented him because he knew him beforehand, worked in the same organisation with the same guy. There's motivation there. It makes sense. It's not hugely complicated, but it's sensible, believable. Whereas in this, she seems to just want to kill him cause her husband wants her to look mean and act badly while doing it on screen. I assume the second bit of what I said there wasn't intended, but it's certainly how it comes across.
Yeah.
I can't see what that character's motivation is for wanting to kill him so badly.
No.
So it's convenient, apparently. Yeah. And then other scenes too that are very like the scenes from the 1990 Total Recall, but worse in every way.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've established the doubt about whether this is actually happening to Arnie or not, and like Sharon Stone turns up unexpectedly on Mars with the Doctor, and he explains the schizoid embolism thing, and then in the context that makes sense, you know, like, why don't I just kill you? It's like, oh, well, you'd see it as murder in your mind, and take this pill, and then there's the very subtle way of how he knows that he's lying, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, the guy gives a long speech, none of which makes sense, and he says, kill her. And he says, why? Because... And then suddenly she's crying, and that's how you know it. It doesn't make any sense at all. And it's like, that was a really, really compact, but very, very efficient scene in the Paul Verhoeven one. It takes 10 minutes and it still doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I think what annoyed me more about this film than anything else is a film where at several points, I think that was actually one of them, it grinds everything to a halt and says, look at us, we're being intelligent. You should think about this film very deeply. And
you haven't. Why should I?
If you give it even the slightest amount of thought, everything about it falls apart. I mean, the whole thing with these elevators with cubes, where they're running about in the external of those, makes no sense whatsoever. It's like, here's an elevator that goes up and down this building, but apparently also goes 8 miles in every direction. All these elements, none of it make any sense. When you...
I know, and there's other bits too. I mean, as I said, I tried to keep an open mind, but...
The hidden rebel base that is... I know enough about the skyline of London to know that that is 3 miles outside of where the last scene was.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's one of the things that's going to... I tried to keep an open mind, but it got shut up pretty quickly, just how stupid it was. So I started nitpicking over everything, but to be honest, that didn't take a lot of effort.
Yeah.
So they've got this bit where... They've said the setup is that there's been chemical warfare on Earth, and there's only two places left to live, which they say originally is the United Federation of Britain, but it seems to be Westminster.
Yeah.
And nothing outside of that, because apparently all the gas from the chemical warfare hangs about just outside London, but stays put in the air and doesn't come in.
Yeah, they put some fans up.
Yeah.
Go away, nasty chemicals.
It's weird, and let's not get on to Bill Nye's performance. Well, he's given much to do, but he does do what he's not given badly. Everything about this film is just, it's stupid, it's ill thought out, I could rant on this for ages, and better not, we've spent quite a long time talking about it anyway.
Yeah.
So, in case you're in any doubt, dear listener, don't watch this, it's pish.
Yep.
So, Scott, a film which I don't even recognise the name of, I'm afraid, so you're going to have to tell me, as well as our listeners, about The Possession.
The Possession, which is otherwise known as the only film available to me when I had a few hours to kill in Nottingham. I mean, I know that, Drew, you have completely sworn off horror films as a sensible, upstanding member of the community that doesn't want to watch any more bad films. I will still be tempted into them occasionally and see something that is, you know, marginally passable, something like The Woman in Black from, was that December? I forget, a little while back. There's an occasional film that I will chance my arm on the occasional horror film. Not like before, where I used to try and watch pretty much everything that came out at cinema and was deluged with so many terrible horror films that I was tempted just to can the whole genre as a bad idea. The Possession is another one of these rare ones that's actually quite well done. It's not perfect, and it's not scary, which is obviously a problem for horror films. Perhaps
I always thought it was a prerequisite, actually,
yeah.
For the ones I've seen.
I'm not sure quite what it is in horror writers and directors' minds that every now and again there comes out a film where it's trying to take something that is the most mundane item you can think of and make it scary. I can understand psychologically the concept behind that, except what they've picked to be scared of is so outrageously stupid that it's never going to fly. And for a while I thought The Possession was going to be one of these films. I'm trying to remember, I think it was the original version of Dark Water where the emblem of fear was supposed to be a Hello Kitty bag. I'm pretty sure I've seen it was either Chinese or possibly a Korean horror film where it was trying to make me desperately afraid of a pair of possessed red shoes. Every now and again, someone just has like a little brainstorm and comes with something that's just a bit silly. In this film, it is a jewellery box, which is probably not inspiring much fear in you, I'm thinking, Drew. That's, if I said jewellery box to you, not recoil in fear from such a horrible concept as this, no?
I can barely speak. Nearly fell off my chair just the thought of it.
What if I told you it was a haunted jewellery box? Ooh. No, still not going for it? Okay. It's okay, Drew. It won't really hurt you.
The earrings. The earrings.
The horrible, horrible bell necklaces. I'm always going to go there. The setup for the film is that Clyde, who's played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, is separated from his wife and gets weekend custody of his two kids. At some point, when they're going off to Clyde's new apartment, they find a yard sale, and the youngest of his two kids takes a fancy to a jewellery box, which calls out to her. She buys it, takes it back home, and becomes increasingly obsessed with this possession of hers, which soon becomes possessing her. Do you see what it's done there? It is a box which apparently has an evil spirit inside it, and over the course of the film, her behaviour deteriorates, she becomes more violent, she basically becomes taken over by the evil spirit inside this box. Eventually, Jeffrey Dean Morgan figures out what's going on and tries to stop it by getting the help of the friendly neighbourhood Hasidic Jew exorcism team. As you do.
Goybusters.
I'd pay to see that film, actually. It's basically Ghostbusters, but with impressive beards. I'd get behind that. It manages to do the whole family setup quite well, in terms of it just being a sort of family drama for the first half hour, as the kids and the adults kind of struggle with the new dynamics of the new family relationship. There's a new kind of stepdad in the scene, and everyone's kind of having a troubled time of it all. No one's particularly happy about anything. And that's done quite well. It's fairly low-key. There's no massive shouting matches, but it's handled quite well as the rational explanation for the turbulence that's caused in the youngest kid's life. After that, it doesn't do too badly in coming out with some weird images, none of which are particularly terrifying, but, you know, there's lots of moths flying out of people and that kind of thing. It's not quite the scariest thing you can imagine, but it does quite well at pulling out a few creepy images here and there, but it's not trying to be out-and-out orchestral stabby shock horror things. It manages to maintain a reasonably creepy atmosphere for most of the film, without ever sort of tipping into being, you know, actually horrific or terrifying. Mm-hmm. But what it is very competently done, much like I would have said about The Woman in Black. It's very well handled, it's very well shot, it's very well acted. There's no weak performance in there, as the kids do quite well. There's not too many weak points in it, apart from the fact that it just isn't really all that scary at the end of the day. If you like more sedately paced, less ridiculous, less schlock horror, gore, fantastic slasher films, and you're more of want something that's a bit more leaning towards psychological horror than anything else, then The Possession is, well, admittedly, it's the only thing I've seen in the last 6 months that is heading that way, but it is pretty good entry into that kind of genre. I wouldn't suggest anyone really run out and see it. It's not so good as to warrant that, but I would imagine it's going to be far better than most of the horror films that will soon be cluttering up our cinemas as we approach Halloween. But it's certainly going to be much better than your average, say, Resident Evil film. Not that I'm damning it with faint praise or anything. No, if you're in the market for a horror film, it's definitely well worth a look. One of the more sort of sedately paced psychological things rather than any video nasties, but yeah, well worth a look. And of course, it's good to see Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who is an actor I like quite a lot, even if he does come across quite often as the poor man's Robert Downey Jr.
He does look remarkably like him, doesn't he?
Yeah. No, mild recommendation, especially to anyone with an interest in the horror genre. I guess from there we shall move into a flick that I literally know nothing about. So Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie, Drew.
If you'll allow me to begin with a caveat, with the exception of a few sketches I've watched on YouTube after seeing them linked on Twitter, I've not watched Tim and Eric, awesome show, great job, the Adult Swim sketch show this is based on. But of the clips I did see, like any sketch show, some were good, others much less so, but I liked a couple of sketches, and so I was at least interested when I saw the trailer a little while ago, and certainly very much so when I saw that Zach Galifianakis, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly were in it. Those all seemed promising things, thought I. So when I saw that Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie was getting a limited release in the UK, I decided to give it a go. Turns out there's a reason it got a limited release. It's craptacular, quite literally at one point. The movie begins with Tim and Eric having received $1 billion from the Schlang Corporation to make a blockbuster movie, but they've squandered the cash by buying diamond suits for an actor and having lots of cosmetic work done, and have only produced about 2 minutes of usable footage. The company want their money back, and Tim and Eric disappear to a derelict small town shopping mall to earn $1 billion. And in the meantime, Mr. Schlang has decided he doesn't want his money anymore, but that the Jew have absconded and he wants to hunt them down and kill them instead. Now, if that sounds rather weird, that's because it's rather weird, and it's undoubtedly a rather weird film. Not that that's necessarily an impediment to my enjoyment. I am a fan of, for instance, both Kids in the Hall and Harry Hill, replete with, you know, chicken ladies, head-crushing badger parades and tinned fish. Sealed. Which are not your mainstream broad comedy by any means. But this is definitely not my cup of weird. And that's fine. If that were the only issue, then no problem. It'd just not be for me. But it's not the only issue. There's a substantially greater issue. And that's that I struggle to see how this film can be for anyone except Tim and Eric. Because as well as being painfully unfunny, it's quite possibly the most horrendously self-indulgent film I've ever seen.
And we've been to a lot of film festivals by this point, so...
Yes, and it's still probably the most self-indulgent film I've ever seen. It's not the most pretentious by any means, so there's certainly far more pretentious films out there, but it's really self-indulgent. The whole thing is structured and everything from the way it's written to what happens to the way it's acted feels like it's been done solely because it amuses them and they don't care whether it amuses anybody else or not. It's one to avoid. I think we could pass on from this quite quickly. It's not a good film at all. I think possibly I was amused 3 times in it. Once by something that's a trailer and 2 things stolen from the Austin Powers.
So going by runtime, that is once every half hour. And I believe, as with some other comedies, I have laughed more often at thin air.
Certainly if the air's thin enough, it starts affecting your mind. I really think enough of that. I would strongly urge no one to ever consider watching that. It is terrible. Okay, so from a film that was stillborn to a film that's stillborn. Scott.
The Bourne Legacy. That's a terrible pun. I'm so upset. I can't believe you came up with that, Drew. It's terrible.
I can't believe you came up either. I must see some sort of evil external influence.
Craig, we miss you, man. We miss you. So, The Bourne Legacy is... Well, I'm going to take issue with IMDb here because I was really hoping that I could steal a plot recap from them.
Well, this is... A new hero whose stakes have been triggered.
Yes, I have never had my stakes triggered. I'm not sure what that would look like or sound like or taste like. Yes, I'm sure it would
I've
be
had
delicious.
My stakes fried, but
The Bourne Legacy is playing in the world of the last 3 Bourne films, but we don't have Jason Bourne himself, which makes it a somewhat strange choice of title. However, the bulk of the film is the new hero Jeremy Renner, who is not part of, I think, the same Treadstone programme, but has basically got the similar kind of abilities. The main difference with him is, I mean, obviously he's still an American agent who is called upon to do the Bond-esque tasks that no one else wants to do to get their hands dirty, deniable ops, that kind of thing. However, the fallout of the previous Bourne films has left Secret Services of America deciding to shut down everything that is Treadstone and Treadstone-like. Turns out they've got about 3 or 4, I think it wound up being, similar but slightly different super spy programs going on at the same time, somewhat competing with each other, which is the problem with the film, I think. Perhaps get onto it later, is it does tend to get a bit too wrapped up in its own mythology for its own good. Long and short of it is they decide to shut down all of these programs and terminate all of the assets on it. The program that Aaron Cross, Jeremy Renner, is part of requires medication every day or so to keep his chemicals and brain chemistry in balance with that kind of thing. And so what they've decided to do is we'll just slip them a Mickey in with their usual doses of medication, which effectively wipes out all of the programme, apart from Jeremy Renner, who happens to have got wind of this and had somehow lost some of his medication and is left as something of a loose end. And he doesn't like being a loose end, so he decides to try and shake out some answers and as to why everything's crashing down around his ears while the program's crashing, and more importantly, to try and get either supplies of the drugs that he needs to live or try and get himself off it. To that end, he finds Raquel Weiss's Dr. Marta Shearing, who was one of the doctors in charge of dosing him with these chemicals, and the two try and come up with some kind of solution to Aaron's dilemma, which basically means that it's a 90-minute chase scene. Awful lot of chasing going on here with the usual kind of Bourne-esque hyper-kinetic camera work. It's not quite as shaky cam as the previous Bourne films, but it's still, you know, quite active, quite driven, and there's obviously a hell of a lot of chasing going on. Basically, it's a big, long action sequence, which doesn't sound too bad. The only problem is that it's just not particularly compelling. It's...
Yeah, it doesn't sound... I mean, the notion of the original Bourne films was that this guy didn't know his past, and that was the driving thing, was that he wanted to know who he was and how he got to be who he was.
This film is basically about a guy trying to find his next fix.
Yeah, it sounds like it's turned from what was rather an interesting concept to bog-standard action film.
Yeah, it just has issues. You've got Edward Norton as the kind of guy that's decided to pull the trigger on all these programs and sort of is somewhat overseeing it all in a kind of very vague way, although he's never actually in the same room as Jeremy Renner, so you don't get any kind of resolution to the conflict that they're trying to build. It's all a bit faceless. There's no conflict that's really set up properly that then gets resolved by the end of the film, whether it's they're trying to have it as a sequel or whatever, I'm not sure, but it also gets a bit tied up in its own mythology because it has so many these programs kicking around that it's decided that when this one guy has gone rogue, how can we stop him? Oh, well, we happen to have this other super spy program over here that's something completely different. It's a little bit better, so we'll get one of him to kill this guy, and then presumably we'll get a better super spy soldier to kill this guy.
Basically, the whole film is there was an old woman who swallowed a fly.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. They'll set a cat to confine the mouse, they'll get a dog, and so on and so forth. It's just a little bit unsatisfying. Now, everything in it is, again, it's very competently handled, but it's just not any fun. I mean, I like Jeremy Renner an awful lot. Ed Norton he's no Brian Cox, but, you know, he'll do, like a nominal bad guy for the piece. Jeremy Renner, I like an awful lot, have done for a while. He plays a good action role. The action sequences are quite well handled. There's no obvious flaws in the mechanics of the film. There's just really no particular reason to care about it. That's okay in something that's kind of lighthearted like The Expendables, where you're not really trying to get yourself invested in any particular character, but here there's a very real need to have some kind of stakes in the survival or otherwise of Aaron Cross, and there is no reason given to care one way or the other about this guy. So all you can do is watch a couple of quite well-executed chase scenes and some, you know, quite well-handled choreography, that kind of thing, and go, yep, that was perfectly acceptable as an action film, but it has no further depth or meaning other than that. Not necessarily that that's a bad thing. If that's the sort of thing you want to do to spend your evening, then that's...
Yeah, but probably shouldn't carry the Bourne name, though, if that's the case of it.
No, and to be fair, you could have... Apart from some characters that kind of show up essentially in cameos, you could have called this any other film you like, and it would have been no better or worse. So it's, you could argue it's a cynical way to kind of cash in on the name. But it's... As I say, it's not bad, but it's very difficult to give any kind of glowing recommendation to a film that is just, at best, competent. So many better films you could spend your time and attention on, so it's difficult to recommend this, but if it does show up on your in-flight entertainment, then it's a decent enough choice to watch, but not something that you'd really want to rush out and sell your granny to get hold of.
Yeah, it does bring up, rather, the irony that we touched on before, perhaps in the third Bourne movie, possibly even as early as the second, that when the Bourne Identity was being produced, the filmmakers had said, we don't want it to be like Bond, we don't want it to get formulaic.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just gone even more down that road, hasn't it?
Yeah.
They've got to the point now, oh, well, there's a name attached. It doesn't appear to bear any relation to the earlier films, but people come and watch it because of the name anyway.
Yeah. And especially ironic given how Bond himself adapted and changed to the...
Yes, the and became more Bourne-like, yes. Yeah.
By no means a bad film, but it's difficult to get excited about the Bourne legacy. From the Bourne legacy to the legacy of socio-economic demographic planning policies in A Simple Life. Drew? No, I'm not going for that one. We really miss Craig, don't we? We need him back.
So A Simple Life then. Ah Tao has served the family of Roger, a Hong Kong film producer, for three generations. When she suffers a stroke, she announces to Roger that she wishes to move into an old people's home. And the film follows Ah Tao as she adjusts to her life in a new home, and Roger as he adjusts to life without Ah Tao. As the film moves on, we discover that Ah Tao wasn't a simple servant, but something closer to a combination of mother and grandmother to Roger and his siblings, having been largely responsible for their upbringing and welfare. Typical class boundaries in Chinese society are broken as Roger helps to look after his former maid, as her health deteriorates and she approaches the end of her life. Now, this film's called A Simple Life, and it's a fairly simple film. It really is just about the relationship between these two people with the background of the wider idea of looking after older people. And the relationship between Andy Lau's Roger and Deanna Eap's Ah Tao, their godson and godmother in real life, is touching and believable. And the film's portrayal both of the deteriorating body and how modern Hong Kong deals with its ageing population is gentle, sad, thought-provoking, often funny, but never mawkish. And while I greatly enjoyed this, it's not something I feel I could recommend to everyone. I think many would become bored by it, which is a real pity, because it's the meandering pace and its portrayal of everyday happenings that makes it so worthwhile. But for those with the patience, it's very, very rewarding and very much worth getting hold of.
I think we'll all agree on this one. I think I had a communique from Craig, I believe he was off, he was in some kind of lederhosen competition, but he did manage to see at least the first hour of this on the plane over, and he very much enjoyed the kind of low-key stylings of it. That's essentially what I would say. I'd echo everything you're saying there. It is a very sedately paced film. I mean, by its very nature, there's not too many ways to liven this up, I would imagine. However, it does everything so very well. The characterization of everyone and the other people in the old folks' home is just charming, and it's very lovely. Yes, it is a very slow watch. It's going to be tough to sell to kind of the more hyper-caffeinated crowd. But if anyone has the kind of slightest interest in either, well, even just human relationships or family relationships, and especially anyone who's with an interest in sociology and the kind of effects on ageing and an ageing society is going to have on these kind of things, it's essential viewing. It's such a lovely film to watch. And, of course, it's something that is going, although it's in Chinese, obviously, and it's particularly, I would imagine, relevant to the kind of Chinese situation, which has an ageing population, and is also dealing with the kind of rapid urbanisation of this, where this, I would imagine, the kind of generation of old people going through might be the first one of people who've moved from the agrarian economies into the centre of cities and try and grow old in a completely alien landscape. So it's got a lot of kind of interesting little aspects to it to keep your brain entertained while it's going on. And yeah, if you've got even the slightest bit of interest in the kind of sociological aspects of this, then it is essential viewing. I very much enjoyed it. Yeah, as you say, definitely not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's, I would imagine, definitely worth everyone at least giving an opportunity. I was very glad to have seen this. It's just charming relationships, lovely film, liked it an awful lot.
Yeah, I've said this in relation to other films before. It's something that people would use almost as a negative, but it's nice.
Yeah.
it does have the thought-provoking things I mentioned about how you deal with the ageing population. I think perhaps Hong Kong less so than some other Chinese cities with the change. It's been a big urban area for longer,
yeah,
I think.
Sure.
But yeah, that's a relevant point. And it's got the thought-provoking bits, but it's just nice.
Yeah.
It's sort of people being people, not shooting each other, not trying to diddle each other, just like people being people, dealing with the things actual real people have to deal with.
Yeah, just people caring about each other, as tends to happen in real life.
Yeah, and in an entertaining way too, though. And it's just such a rewarding watch. You get a nice, warm feeling at the end of it. It's like, you just want to get there and just go,
no.
Ah. As we satisfied sigh. It's the sort of film I suspect could easily turn up maybe BBC Four or Film Four sometime quite soon.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely worth keeping an eye out for.
Yeah, certainly of all the serious dramas I've seen this year, it ranks among the highest.
Well, Scott, I believe you watched The Watch. Was The Watch worth the watch of The Watch?
No. Next.
I think so. Move on. It did look terrible from the trailer.
Giving it a bit of a short shrift there. Right? The Watch it's mediocre, but it's by no means the worst comedy I've seen, but it doesn't quite deliver on anything that it wants to do. I gave this the benefit of the doubt, mainly because although the trailer looked rubbish, the directors, Akiva Schaffer of Lonely Island fame, who's done a lot of things that I like, Ben Stiller, hit and miss, but probably more hits than misses, in my opinion, for his comedies, and he's done some really funny ones
so.
In the past.
Done stuff like Dodgeball and Zoolander and Tropic Thunder. That makes up for a lot of the worst stuff.
Exactly. Vince Vaughn, same argument, and
absolutely.
Same films
some
in a lot of
films,
cases.
Yeah.
Jonah Hill, nothing against the guy, quite funny most parts. Hasn't been given a chance to show much range yet, I don't think, but yeah. Don't
know, Moneyball gave him he actually got a bit of a chance to show a straight side Moneyball, which is
quite nice.
I've not
seen Moneyball yet, which is to my eternal shame. I should really try and catch
I wouldn't knock your pan out. And I've got a passing interest in baseball, and I was finding that quite tiresome. You've got none, so
somewhat less than none. It's
yes,
very much in the negatives for me in terms of baseball. And of course, Richard Ayoade, who directed the excellent Submarine. I was drawing a blank on that. And of course, excellent
Lost
in the IT Crowd.
Great. Yes.
And excellent with Nathan Barley from back in the day.
And Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, of course.
Absolutely. See,
there's
see.
Basically nothing I've seen Richard Ayoade in that I don't like him in.
Exactly. So there was enough talent in front of and behind of the camera to at least give this a bash. Yeah. It was almost kind of worth it. It's the sort of film where you kind of walk out thinking, well, it wasn't a complete waste of a time, but I could probably have spent it better doing an awful lot of other things tonight. Their plot, well, I suppose I should mention the plot. There's a neighbourhood watch group formed by Ben Stiller and aforementioned actors, and they find that aliens are invading. Surprisingly, no one believes them, so they try and stop it themselves. Comic hijinks, are kind of plotted to ensue, but perhaps don't quite exactly do so. It's one of these comedies where it has its moments, but it just doesn't have anything like enough of those moments to maintain interest throughout the whole of the piece. There's nothing that's outrageously bad, there's just points where it just kind of slows down and gets a bit boring. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do a kind of stupid comedy film about aliens invading and four goofballs trying to stop it, I really don't need some kind of subplot where two of these goofballs struggle with complications and relationships caused by one of them's impotence. It just doesn't fit. It just drags everything else down. It's not funny. It doesn't actually make me care about any of these characters because it's a stupid goofball comedy. I'm not going to care about any dramatic elements of it because that would be a waste of my time and everyone else's. There's some points in there that are actually quite well handled and a few quite funny moments, but there's only really three or four of those, and the rest of it is kind of a fairly low-grade comedy. Most of it is trying to really drive itself through, I think. It almost coasts by on the kind of charm that Vince Vaughn and kind of Ben Stiller have, kind of needling each other relationship. They have enough kind of charisma to kind of almost pull that out, and the Vince Vaughn-Jonah Hill dynamic works quite well also. So it does the best it can with what it has. It's just a really weak script. There's not enough funny things have been written. I can easily imagine that if you had any other people in the lead roles, this could have been a disastrously boring and deeply unfunny watch. It's a comedy that's sort of elevated by its cast and what they've done with it, rather than something that you see some comedies that are so well written you could swap out practically anybody and it would still be really funny. This, no, it doesn't work. It's kind of all predicated on the kind of charisma of the performances, and it's painfully obvious that they don't really have much else to back it up with other than their charisma. I suppose it's an achievement that they've managed to kind of pull it off to an extent. I mean, as I say, it's not what you'd call a bad film. It's just a kind of pretty mediocre one, and something that is, at the end of the day, for a comedy, just not funny enough often enough to be worth any recommendation from myself. From a film I would recommend bailing on to a film starring Christian Bale. The Flowers of War. Come back, Craig, please.
Yes, please. Save us from ourselves.
Yeah. Flowers of War, Drew. What's that all about?
Or at least we can blame you instead for the terrible jokes. Directed by Zhang Yimou, famous for the stylish historical epics Hero and House of Flying Daggers, amongst others, The Flowers of War is, thus far, the most expensive Chinese film ever made. As for what it's about, on the 13th of December 1937, Imperial Japanese forces entered and captured the Chinese city of Nanjing. Their six-week occupation of the city, in which as many, in some estimates, as 300,000 Chinese, mostly civilians, were killed, has become infamous as the Rape of Nanjing. And it's into this setting that The Flowers of War takes us. John Miller, played by Christian Bale, finds himself trapped in the city, sheltering in the Catholic cathedral he was on his way to in order to bury its priest. Demanding payment for the children to live there at the convent school, he refuses to leave and settles in to hide from the Japanese and drink the cathedral's wine until he gets paid. But the arrival, firstly of a group of prostitutes seeking shelter, and then Japanese soldiers intent on removing the school's virgin girls to be sex slaves, forces him to reevaluate his priorities and become a better man than the drunken waster he appears to be. And if that sounds cliched, it's nothing compared to the prostitutes, the leader of whom is the archetypal hooker with a heart of gold. But this can be leavened somewhat with the knowledge that there were stories from the event of Westerners trying to protect Chinese and prostitutes who sacrificed themselves in place of children.
For me, the only real problem with the film was that it does kind of come across as something of a gross oversimplification of events and a propaganda piece at best. I can kind of let it slide because by most of the contemporary accounts, I don't even think the Japanese are denying it too much, what happened was comic book evil. So you have the Japanese going about with the almost manga-esque bad guy features and doing manga-esque bad guy things, but it seems that that's actually more or less what happened.
Yeah.
History seems to have kind of settled on it. This was a disgraceful event in anyone's history. So I kind of let it slide on that basis. And the rest of it, while it's cliche-ridden in almost every piece and execution of it, from the kind of redemption of Christian Bale's character to the relationships with the hookers and the young kids and such like, and the hugely cliche-driven, but as we've said before many times in the past, the cliches are there because for the most part they kind of work, and Flowers of War for me kind of worked as well. It does all that stuff well enough. It's obvious enough where it's trying to, you know, tug your heartstrings and pull you around, but it does it so well, I don't mind it being so obvious. So that's my taking on it in the short term. I think everyone does, all the performances are pretty well handled. There's lots of nice touches in there, you know, from everyone up to the ridiculously heroic Chinese soldier towards the start of the film, and Christian Bale's redemption. Also, you don't need us to tell you that Christian Bale's quite a good actor. I think everyone's convinced of that by this point. Yeah, it all works well enough to be well worth a watch. It doesn't look like the most expensive Chinese film I've ever seen.
I suppose I can
kind of understand where it comes from, but it doesn't really look like a lot of that's on the screen.
Yeah, there's also the problem too, is visually there are bits that are quite stunning looking, and then there are bits that are like so clearly like a soundstage, and it's kind of jarring, actually, how different, for instance, the inside of the cathedral looks to the war-ravaged town.
Yeah.
And there are bits, too, the way you talk, like, sort of manga villains, you know, it points the Japanese are portrayed as maniacally laughing monsters.
Yeah.
And I think that would work if the film were told from the point of view of the children. But it's not. The film's told from the point of view of Christian Bale. So it feels a bit mixed that way. If it'd been told from the point of view of, like, 13-year-old girls, then you sort of seen these laughing monsters kind of works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly not a perfect film, but it's certainly worth watching. And I mean, I've been aware for a long, long time of The Rape of Nanjing, but never seen a film about it. So it's quite interesting to see that. Same way that, considerably worse film, but The Letters from Iwo Jima, which was the follow-up to Flags of Our Fathers by Clint Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the films were, well, boring, quite frankly. But Letters from Iwo Jima was a much more compelling watch, simply because it was a point of view of things that I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And I think Flowers of War has that going in its favour here, as well as being a better film. The clichés are problematic, but as you're right, Scott, it's not a death knell to the film. The performances are great. Christian Bale's character is kind of underwritten.
Hmm.
I actually was feeling really tired, so watched the second half of this film on a different day. And I must have started watching again right about the time where Christian Bale's character changes, and it felt like two different films with two different characters.
Yeah, he's a bit binary, isn't he?
Yeah, it's like a switch going on.
I'm a drunken layabout. Oh no, now I'm good, notwithstanding, all of a sudden.
Yes, exactly. drunk hero. Like that. So this character's a bit underwritten, but he does very well with what he's given, which isn't a lot. Christian Bale's a particular favourite around these parts. Yeah, it's cliche, I'd say. It's helped that it's based on reality. The only other problem I had with it is that it's a bit too comic book in some places. Like, there's sort of really stylistic shots of people being shot. And it just, for a war film, felt out of place. So it's some kind of gangster film, like Sin City or something. That's the sort of shots you would expect.
Yeah.
And this, it just felt like the director's so used to being stylish that he's going to put stylish in here, whether it's merited or not.
It kind of works for me in as much as this is a propaganda film. I can see where they pulled it. They've come at it from that angle rather than it being... It's not really a serious war film, I think, in any real sense. It's almost Battleship Potemkin-esque in its glorification of the Chinese elements of this war. Yeah, so in that basis, it kind of works. It's more of an Eisenstein piece than it is any sort of gritty realism.
Yeah, that's a fair comment.
And to be honest, I would have thought that would be a real negative. But it kind of seems to be justified by the kind of actual events. But, I mean, I can't imagine sort of recommending two people go and see a piece of Chinese propaganda, but this kind of does work, so what the hell?
Yeah, that's the problem. And as I said about the kind of laughing monster thing, and if you're, like, this 13-year-old girl who's quite prominent in it, and this is how you're seeing what's happening and not really understanding things, I can see that, but it's not from her point of view. And the Japanese do feel one-dimensional for all the horrible stuff they did.
Yeah.
They still feel incredibly one-dimensional, even when they're doing the horrible stuff. It's like, humans are more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward film.
Yes.
There are bad people and there are good people, and they got into a fight. And I think history would record it as being somewhat more complicated than that in reality.
Yeah, because one of the thoughts I had too is, like, I know the Japanese were guilty of huge amounts of crime through most of East and Southeast Asia during World War II, and the Sino-Japanese War, which was just before that, which is where this takes place. And it's, you hear so much about it that I don't doubt that most of it's true. Right, most people seem to think that's the case, and as much as it can be proved. They're saying, look, these evil Japanese came and killed us poor Chinese. And that is the country of Chairman Mao. He killed way more Chinese than the Japanese ever did.
Hmm.
And he was Chinese. So it's that kind of thought was at the back of my head through most of this. Just trying to paint themselves particularly clean or white in this.
Yeah, I get that sort of undercurrent myself when I was watching it. It's always just something there nagging at the back of your mind, isn't it? I was trying to convince myself that it's actually quite a good film, and I'm enjoying. Well, enjoying is the wrong word, but I'm engaged by this film. It's not it's not a cheery watch, obviously, by any stretch of the imagination. But I was engaged with it, and I thought it was a competent film, and I really liked it an awful lot. But at the same time, there's always something at the back of my head going, "This is just a little bit too." Flag waving on the back of the. I don't know if I'm being overly critical at that point. Certainly, it never managed to override the main sensation of actually being quite engaged and enjoying the film. So, on that basis, I can recommend it.
Yeah, it's worth a watch, but it's not as good as it could be, in the very least. And there are huge caveats to the film. It's worth a viewing. That rather lengthy list being finally concluded, that's it from us for now. You can, of course, contact us at podcast@theoneliner.com or follow us on Twitter @theoneliner. For now, that's goodbye from me and goodbye from Scott.
Goodbye.
Bye. That'll do.
Enough. Stop.
It was rather dull and perfunctory, but that's fine. Oh, sorry, I was nodding there.
Yeah.
Because that comes across so well in audio.
We'll put an animated gif in.
I'll attach a bell around my neck so you'll hear me nodding.